I'm sitting here in my lonely studio, riffling through Ingo Petsky's biography of sorts of Philip Noyce. I say of sorts because it excludes a lot of personal stuff, but pretty much focuses, and rightly so, on Philip Noyce's extraordinary film career. I've been watching Phil's career with fascination for well over 30 years, from films like Backroads and Newsfront to his redemptive triumph in Rabbit Proof Fence, and of course in between the extraordinarily successful years in Hollywood, which I have to say made many of his erstwhile friends in Australia deeply resentful. But Phil, I think they all had to eat their words and apologise after Rabbit Proof. Did they do so?
I don't know, mate. I obviously was at different parties than you were. I didn't hear all the abuse, but I'll come around and let you give me all the details.
Okay. Let me also introduce your biographer, Ingo Petsky. Now, Ingo, I'd like to deal with you first. Phil can just sit quietly and calmly for a minute.
That's hard.
How come a fellow born in Germany, a filmmaker of the same era as Philip, has selected Noyce as a topic, as a subject? What drew you to him?
Well, it's actually a story with many things that simply happened. I had been to Australia for one semester as a visiting professor at Queensland University of Technology in 1992. And while I was there, obviously, I had to do something meaningful, so I started to become interested in Australian feature film. And during the 4 months I spent at QUT, I probably have seen between 200 and 250 Australian feature films. So I got a pretty good idea of the good ones and the, unfortunately, not so good ones. But when I returned to Germany, I was trying to run a little strand of Australian and New Zealand films at our local festival, which was a nice one because it was all done and organized by volunteers, by idealists, and everyone contributed a little bit with their special expertise and their interest to it. And so I tried to get as many Australian films as possible. And we had people there like Bruce Beresford or John Dygan, where we screened little retrospectives. And then there was my good friend, my best Australian friend in those days, Ian Stocks, and he suggested that maybe we should invite Philip Noyce. And I thought, oh, my, he is so high up in Hollywood, I doubt we can get him. And he said, well, I may have a chance to contact him because we used to know each other from the days of the Sydney Filmmakers Cooperative. And in fact, which I found always amazing, if you contact Australian filmmakers, they are really approachable. I mean, they're not hidden behind walls of assistants and agents that you can never reach them. You can talk to them. And Philip rather unexpectedly said, oh, yes, okay, I will come. I'd like to come. So he came over and to the festival in Germany, and the next morning he was so kind to come and give a little lecture to my students at the university. And this was so wonderful. I mean, he's a great raconteur, as you're all aware. And I looked at Ian, whom we had flown in from Australia, and he looked at me and he said, well, I mean, somebody should really tape all these stories he's telling and make a book out of it. So
which is exactly what you've done. I would suggest, Philip Noyce, that there's a pre-existing circumstance, and that is that the Germans were always very kind to the young Australian industry. The Berlin Festival went out of its way to encourage us in the 70s.
Yes, they did. The Germans have this strange fascination with our land.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. And that extends from the north to the south. There's a real enthusiasm for things Australian, and particularly for Indigenous Australia, right across Germany.
And our attempts to have a revived film industry are largely coincidental, and many of the same influences of underground movies apply, don't they?
They did, and the Germans had a similar system to the one that you were instrumental in devising for us here in Australia, in as much as a system that relied on government interaction with filmmakers.
I want to have a little political discussion right up front, and then we'll get onto the films themselves.
By the way, Philip, I am right, aren't I, in saying that you were one of the architects of the revival of the Australian film industry?
Modesty forbids, yes, but the three-tier argument was one that Barry Jones and I Seoul to a rapid succession of prime ministers and then to state premiers. But Phil, a couple of months ago I was feeling a bit bitter and twisted about our industry, the fact that it had moved almost entirely offshore. And I was describing the Oscars as golden nails in the coffin of the Australian film industry. But a number of directors, and some of the cinematographers, are now coming back to the industry that nurtured them.
And many of the actors are about to as well.
Well, thank God for that. But you in fact, have made a political decision, haven't you, to be, if you like, culturally ambidextrous, to still work in the US, but to emphatically re-involve yourself with here.
Yes. It's political, it's also cultural, it's also for my own personal sanity. And it's also because of a feeling of obligation, an obligation to all those Australian taxpayers who have invested in an Australian film industry and must be feeling lately that they're not getting a good return for the shares that they've purchased, rather like buying Telstra shares, I guess. Yes, I've decided to try and make as many films as I can here in Australia, either as a director or as a producer. And I'm producing a large number of movies, I hope.
So you're going to what, mentor some younger directors?
Yeah. I'm making a film that's being written by Ian David and directed by Jonathan Teplitsky, who was responsible for last year's Getting Square. I'm producing a film which is being written and will be directed by Darlene Johnson, Indigenous film director. I'm producing a film that will be written by, that is being written by Pip Carmel, adapted from Geraldine Brooks' book Years of Wonder.
I can't wait for your next collaboration with Bob Ellis, Philip.
Well, that's a tragedy. As Ellis says in Ingo's book, we could have had a great relationship. It's all spoiled on that movie. I'd love to collaborate with Bob Ellis.
Well, you've got to look after these young writers and these young directors, Phil. You know, I shall be a go-between
But, mate, you've been there. You've mentored everyone.
Anyway, look, it's fascinating to have the two of you on. I should point out to the Gladys that the book is very largely on the basis of transcripts with very good little editorial in-betweens. Why that format, Ingo?
Well, I mean, as I pointed out before, Philip is really a great raconteur, and he knows how to tell stories. And actually, if you look at it, I find it's quite amazing and astonishing that the background to a lot of the films is at least as interesting and as funny or thrilling, whatever, as the films themselves. And
well, sometimes more so. For me, I was fascinated, Philip, by the struggles you had with Tom Clancy. I hadn't realised that you'd gone through a process of, shall we say, de-Ramboising him, you know, of making those films into less Republican right-wing raves.
Right. And, of course, suffered his anger as a result. Very.
Would you ever work in that town again as a result of these revelations?
No, certainly I will. You know, it's a democratic town. And as I point out, it also made me popular with the left-leaning New York Times film critics, who were only too glad to bash Clancy while praising my adaptations.
Philip, you complained about the sort of the cultural claustrophobia that you were feeling towards the end of your first great Australian career. Was that the only motive for going across the Pacific to the city-state that you quite correctly describe as dominating the globe, and particularly?
Well, I turned 40, and I looked in the mirror and thought, there's the Philip Noyce as he's evolved, if you could call it that. That's the guy that everyone thinks he is. And here I have this phone that keeps ringing with these Americans saying, come on over. And I thought, why not go over and reinvent myself? I mean, we'd all love to do it. You've done it a couple of times, Phil. So I took the opportunity to be another Philip Noyce.
Were you welcomed?
Absolutely welcomed. You know, we were, in those days, as today, as Australian filmmakers, fully trained, battle ready, thanks to the Australian taxpayers' dollars that funded the film school and the Experimental Film Fund and the Australian Film Development Corporation and all of that, fully trained and ready for battle, but very pragmatic because we'd made films very cheaply and we knew the process of developing, of shooting and of distributing films. Because I grew up in the era, like you, where you had to go and four-wall your films.
And when you and Russell were making Backroads, for example, you were on a big 300 a week, weren't you?
We certainly were, yeah. Although 300 was big in those weeks, in those days.
I was fascinated to learn from Ingo's book that you liked the tent shows, that you liked Jimmy Charman, who was sort of born into them,
right?
That you were inspired by them.
Yeah, well, that was our entertainment prior to television in a small country town in outback New South Wales, or country New South Wales, or Griffith, where I grew up. Television came in 1963, 7 years after it came to Sydney and Melbourne. And so I grew up waiting for those tent shows to come. Worth Circus was the greatest of them all. It came with its own train, and the Worth family lived in the first two carriages with their silver service dining set. And I would come up and look in the train window and look at the lifestyle and think, my God, I'd love to hop on that train and drive off into the sunset. And I guess that's what I've done.
It's interesting that those trains are pretty well stopped now. The sad thing, I love Australian circuses. I love the battered, footsore, weary nature of them, and they've just about all gone to God
now. Yep. There's a few that keep on going.
Yeah. But that storytelling impulse, or that sense of drama, is clearly seen in your work. But the thing about you that separates you from your contemporary directors, from Bruce Beresford, who is politically conservative, from Peter Weir, who I don't think has ever really had a political thought, you are the one of all of the directors here that does seem to have a political or a social justice thread to your work.
I guess. It comes, I think, from two factors. One was my father, who was and still is the most elastic man I've ever met.
What do you mean elastic?
Elastic, meaning that he can see the world from many points of view at the same time. An enormous advantage. An example, he's 85. On Sunday, I had lunch with him again, first time in about 3 months, and his topic of conversation was, what is the difference between a freedom fighter and a terrorist? And he couldn't find much difference. That was his personality, and his elasticity was a great influence on me. His sister was bayoneted to death by the Japanese when she was captured with those 19 nurses off the coast of Borneo, and yet the riddle was that he was so fascinated with the Japanese culture and loved Japanese culture. So that was the kind of man who influenced me greatly. The other factor was growing up in one of the 190 towns of New South Wales that had an Aboriginal reserve or an Aboriginal prison outside the town, the place where the local the original inhabitants had been herded and were now living in semi-incarceration. That's an image, an indelible image, that you can never forget. And coming to terms with that, whether it's expressed in a film like Rabbit Proof Fence or Backroads or just in your other work, is something that, you know, you have to be committed to.
Phil,
to understanding how that could have happened.
I saw Backroads in that little semi-outdoor cinema in Broome. You'd been there the week earlier. And the thing that saddened me was that there were no Aborigines in the audience. Because Broome, despite its incredible indigenous tradition, is still not the most welcoming place for people.
Yes, that's true. And there's a lot of sadness on that peninsula, of course, from the various invasions that have taken place over the years.
It's good, isn't it, that film has defied all the
We're talking about not Backroads, but Rabbit Proof Fence.
We're talking about Rabbit Proof Fence. Defied all the predictions. Since Jimmy Blacksmith, it was an article of faith or faithlessness in the Australian industry, particularly at distributor and finance level, that if a film even mentioned a black fella, it would go straight down the gurgler. And you were told the film couldn't work and shouldn't be done.
And it was due to the hard work of individual cinema owners, as you know, Natalie Miller, who runs the Nova Cinema in Melbourne, took over $360,000 at that cinema, one cinema, with Rabbit Proof Fence. The Broom Cinema ran it for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was individual cinema owners. The Luna Leaderville in Perth ran the film for 4 months. It was due to the enthusiasm and the hard work of one by one.
But Philip, that's back to our roots, isn't it? Because, as you mentioned earlier, when we made films in the early 70s, mid-70s, even into the 80s, often we couldn't get major distribution, so you'd all them.
And I'll never forget, you set the example back there in the early 70s with Baz and McKenzie. When you couldn't get a deal that was satisfactory, you just hired the cinemas and showed the film yourself. And really, you set the benchmark that all of us needed to follow.
It belongs to a guy called Keith Adam, who used to roadshow himself, not through roadshow. He'd roadshow a film called Northern Safari.
I remember that.
Do you remember
that?
In town halls.
Yeah.
But
in fact, it goes back further, probably to the surfing movies that were roadshowed up and down the coast. David Elphick, of course, who was the producer of my first full-length feature, Newsfront, that's how he got into the business, with a 16mm projector moving up and down the Masonic halls and the RSL halls up and down the coast, showing surfing movies, including some of the ones that he'd made as well.
Ingo, any parallel for this sort of stress and struggle in Germany?
No, not really with the feature films, no matter if they are low budget or there are no big budget ones in Germany. The major difference being that very early on in the cultural discussion in Germany, we had something that's called the municipal cinemas that came into effect. And these municipal cinemas, they are highly subsidized by the town councils by the state. And what they're doing is they're screening retrospective, they're screening art house cinemas, they're open to all kinds of genres, including experimental film, documentaries, and so on.
Mm.
And they're really, really important. And I think that was one of the most important cornerstones in the development of film consciousness in Germany, what these municipal cinemas are doing.
I tried to set up a parallel operation here. I bought a cinema in Hobart with Gough Whitlam's money, and then we opened the Cheval, the Lumiere, to do this. But in the between time, it was suddenly discovered that Australian films could be quite successful. But let's move away from making films with no money to, Philip, your career making films with lots and lots. Did that produce its own special problems? In other words, what was the culture shock of suddenly having megabucks as opposed to a few coins in a tin?
Well, you realise that you are really directing traffic, because that's what it was like. You had two or three units.
In what sense?
Well, because you had two or three units, you know, part of the film, the aeroplane sequences or the boat sequences or something else would be directed by a second unit, and then there'd be the explosions that had to be done by a third unit, and then there'd be the models or whatever, the blue screens or the infrared photography that for another sequence that would be done by a fourth unit. So, you know, it really was directing traffic.
But what about dealing with the big money people that were...
With the big money people was never a problem until the preview. That's when that's when the executives came down on you like a ton of bricks. 70 was the big score. No, it was, you know, was it 70? No, it's 80. 80 was the big score. You had to score 80. I forget what the big score was now. No, it was 70. 70 was the score you had to score. What they do in Hollywood, they've been doing it since the early 30s, is they show the incompleted film, partially cut film, to an audience who are invited along, recruited at outside cinemas or in supermarkets and malls, and the audience are invited to tick various boxes and rate all the elements on the movie.
I did that in New York once for an obscure film called Apocalypse Now, which I saw as a double head, and I ticked a lot of boxes for that. So he owes it all to me.
Right.
So what happened when you were when your boxes were being ticked?
Sometimes my boxes got ticked, and tickled in the right places, like Clear and Present Danger, where Harrison wanted to recut the film, and I thought, oh my God, how am I going to get around this one? So I thought, okay, I'll invite an audience in and see what they think.
Did you branch stack, did you, Philip?
I tried to. They ticked 80% positive, so I got out of that one. Whereas on the other hand, with The Quiet American, even an art house, so-called art house film, post 9/11, we were scoring, well, we started at 48, and when we got down to 21 out of 100, which was 3 months after 9/11, I knew that it was better to stop screening the film because zero was a point of no return. The film was just, you know...
How do you account for that? Was it the WTC attacks, or was it deeper?
Yeah. It was always going to be a hard sell to Americans, this idea that they might have been terrorists at some point. In fact, we all know that they invented terrorism back in the War of Independence. But after 9/11, and I guess it was pretty stupid of us to keep going back to those same cinemas in the New Jersey area where people who had been personally affected by the attacks were living, but we did. The audience disliked the movie at the first screening, and they disliked it more and more as we kept showing it to them.
How did it go finally, when belatedly it was released?
Well, you know, this very egalitarian system of measuring movie satisfaction or moviegoer satisfaction. It's called IMDb, Internet Movie Database, I think is the full name, and they have these graphs. People can vote on movies, and if you look at the voting on The Quiet American, you'll find that the votes are much higher in America than they are outside the country. So finally, the film did find its audience, and finally the film was much admired by Americans, although I suppose it's also true to say that a preview audience, where you're drawing on a general public who don't know what they're going to see, and this is the problem with the previewing system, is different to an audience who decide as a result of advertising and other stimuli that they're going to see a particular movie. And that's the problem with the preview system, you know. Generally, the people who give you the negative responses would have never come to see your movie if they'd known exactly what they were getting into before they stepped into that cinema.
One of the most interesting things in Ingo's book is his, your collaboration, the two of you, on your treatment of actors' film. I remember one of the things that Fred Skepsi used to do on a shoot was he would walk up to an actor just before the take and say, "Your father's dead." You know, he would sort of throw the poor bastard and get an unexpected emotional response. You seem to treat actors very much more kindly.
Well, I certainly haven't tried that one. I'm not sure what kind of response you might get. Your father's dead, wow. I believe that you should try and unleash the power of the actor, that you should invest in them as much as possible, that you should try and allow them to speak with voices, to become the character, not just to study what the character's life is like and past is like, but to actually take over, to become a screenwriter and a director, to take absolute responsibility for what the character does on the screen.
I understand you learned a lot from George Ogilvie about the treatment of the thespian.
Yeah. George Miller, back in those days when Kennedy Miller Studios were producing so much television for broadcast on Network 10, those miniseries, The Dismissal, Kara Breakout, The Bodyline, Bangkok Hilton, and so on. George was and still is an idealist, a left-brain thinker, and he used the money that he made from Mad Max 1 with Byron Kennedy to finance many things, one of which was an investigation into storytelling, an investigation into the art of acting and directing, the relationship between actors and directors that went on for many years. That was the greatest film school I ever went to. And George Ogilvie was instrumental in revealing many of the techniques that he'd developed in opera and theatre and revealing them to us film directors like Chris Noonan, John Dygan, Carl Schultz, George Miller, and myself.
Ingo, why has the German industry lost its way, or seems to have lost its way? This question I'm going to put to Phil shortly in an Antipodean version.
Well, I'm not really sure. I think for a long time the German film industry, if you can call it a film industry, it's more like a cottage industry anyway. It was a couple of names, and they could go on with their films, and I think to a certain degree they disrespected the audience. I find it very striking when I talk to Phil about this, not the German one, but in general, and what does he get out most of filmmaking? And he said he loves to entertain the people he loves, that the people get the best value out for the money that they pay at the box office. And I think that has been forgotten for a long time with a lot of the German filmmakers. They just kept on because they had the possibility to access these grants. And there was this famous German film writer who then became a director, which is, I think, it was a bit ironically, Hans C. Blumenberg, and he once wrote in the major German weekly, he said there must be a constitutional right for every German at least once in his life to be able to make a feature film with taxpayers' money. It was a bit like this. And the younger ones, they are much more influenced by Hollywood these days. They are much more friendly to the audience, but they seem to have lost their big subjects and the topics that the earlier ones had. So I think maybe, hopefully, eventually it will balance it out, and we may have both ways.
I think, Phil, by the way, that he just answered your question about the Australian film industry as well.
Yes, I was going to suggest it sounded pretty close to the money. But, Philip, what was there in your era when, in the 70s and then flowing into the 80s, what was it that energised the narratives? Why did we get it right so often then and right so rarely now?
The first thing was that we were engaged in a war. The war was with the Americans. We were determined to free up the screens that seemed to be mortgaged by the Yanks and their distribution companies. We were determined to put our stories up there. We were determined to seize those screens back. There was that was very much a baby boomer preoccupation as well. There was a sense of nationalism back in the late 60s, you remember, and the early 70s. It coincided, of course, with the election of the Whitlam government eventually, although it wasn't started by the Whitlam
government. Now, we have to put that on record, as Gough himself does, that it was John Gorton who was the first one to pick up the cudgels. But he accepted that thesis. He was also anti-American.
But we were in a revolution. And like all great revolutions, they go rotten eventually. Maybe that's what's happened. But also, that group of filmmakers started out making films for nothing and having to do everything themselves. Write the scripts, photograph them, act in them, put up the posters, find the audience, convince the audience to come and see the movies. We started with short films. We took nothing for granted. It was a gift. Everything that happened was a gift. We were so glad to be expressing ourselves in such a vital art form as cinema. But underneath it all was that war that we were fighting, and that's what fueled us. There was something else. We had an audience that had a narcissistic relationship with the material, like a baby looking in a mirror. The Australian audience back in the 70s were fascinated with the images of themselves, the reflection of their own lives that they were seeing up on the silver screen. We could make the films cheaply enough until about 1980 and the introduction of that tax system of financing. We could make them cheaply enough that we could return the money in Sydney and Melbourne alone for so many of the movies. Once it became a lifestyle choice, to quote Mr. Rosen from the FFC, once it became a lifestyle choice to be a filmmaker, and once it became too easy, it seemed as though everything became corrupted, and the economics as well as the cultural aspects of filmmaking
changed. I accept that thesis without equivocation, but it sometimes seems to me that your generation of filmmakers has to bear a little bit of the responsibility, because having made $300 a week, having starved making films, you went off to the great casino.
And we did, that's true, but imagine if we stayed. Imagine the blood that would be on the floor as we fought with each other. Weir fights Beresford, fights Skepsi, fights Noyce, fights Miller for too little money. I mean, what would have happened? I mean, I agree with you. We did cash in our chips. Some of us have come back. But what would have happened if we stayed? Do you think that I would have a feature film industry career? No, I'd be lucky to be making television commercials and wouldn't even get a Guernsey doing that.
Well, let's flip it over a bit. Hollywood has always, for its entire history, flourished by hoovering in the talent of the world. You know, whether it was, you know, Eisenstein on, you know, any significant director in the world was seduced at least briefly by that great machine. I'm wondering whether the Australians took any detectable Australian quality with them into the screens, into the cinemas. Not into the business, because I think you've already dealt with that. The training, the depth, the breadth of the training. But on the screen, in an American film, is there an Australian, some sort of residual quality?
Absolutely there is. There's a sense of egalitarianism, there's a sense of humanism that runs through all the Australian director's work, whether it's directing films in Australia or in America. Look at the films of Peter Weir, look at Beresford's work.
Give me a for example in Peter Weir.
American, what is it called? The Dead Poets Society. I mean, it's the humanism of that story that finally separates it from any treatment that an American director would have come up with.
You can certainly see an Australian instinct in, say, Tender Mercies, can't you? Bruce's
absolutely
debut film
can. Not just an Australian instinct in the treatment of the characters, but in the framing, in the telling of the story visually. You know, it could almost have been set in Australia. Well, it was set on, you know, in a landscape that reminded one of Australia, but the bleakness of the framing and the settings, they were so Australian.
Ingo, do you agree with that, or do you think we're sort of romanticising?
No, I think an additional thing that often strikes me, or that is the thing that I really dislike about Hollywood, at least in recent years, is they always have the superheroes who fight everything, and that's what the film is about. And I have grown tired of this. It was fascinating for some time, but I've grown tired, and I like films about ordinary people and ordinary lives. There's so much fun and adventure in there as well, and I think that's a good thing in a lot of the European film, and I think that's a good thing in a lot of the Australian films as well, and you don't find this in Hollywood.
What do you think about the backlog culture now, Philip? I know that when you and I were young and full of promise, we worried about it then, that one of these days we would be taken over in the way, say, the British industry was for decades, or the Spanish, and used as a cheap place to make films. Now, of course, the country is littered with studio complexes that may be underused, but they still suck up a lot of energy and a lot of money, and we spend, it seems to me, too much time making prequels for Mr. Lucas.
Well, I don't know if there are many disadvantages to all of this. In many ways, it was the Matrix series and all the money that the post-production houses and facilities were making working on films like that allowed, say, Animal Logic to do the CGI work for Rabbit Proof Fence so efficiently.
Would you explain that connection? Because that's fascinating.
Okay, well, Animal Logic did a lot of the CGI work, the computer-generated imagery for The Matrix. They made many millions of dollars, I hope. They certainly did millions of dollars worth of work for American companies. I came along with a little film called Rabbit Proof Fence. I needed some very special CGI work done throughout the film, putting in clouds, making a storm, turning day into night towards the end in a sequence that we could only shoot it in full daylight because the children couldn't stay up after too long after dark. Various things throughout the movie. Didn't have a lot of money. But they had the expertise because they'd practiced on the big American movies, and in a way they had the ability to be charitable towards my movie, because they'd made all their profit on the American film. So it works both ways.
If you move that argument back 20 years, of course, the same thing could be said about the advertising industry, because many of our directors and technicians
grew up making ads.
You know, yeah. Multinational corporation mendicants.
So I see there are some disadvantages, I suppose. You could argue that the price of a camera may be greater because people are used to earning so much money for it. But it hasn't really worked like that on a practical level. It's just meant that film crews can still decide that they'll work for $300 a week, making the film of their choice, but now they can actually afford to do it because they've earned their $3,000 a week on the American movie.
Ingo was talking a moment ago about the triumphalism of American cinema, the hero invariably winning. You come from an industry where most of the early films were about
failure.
About noble failures. I'm wondering to what extent you've ever had to recast your work to feed the American appetite for optimism and upbeat. Didn't something like that happen with Dead Calm?
Did it? Not really. It was the opposite. Dead Calm, we finished with an ending where Billy Zane's character, the American baddie, disappeared into the ocean, never to be seen again. After the first screenings, I wasn't at that screening, but Warner Brothers convinced us all that the audience expected that the monster had to come back and the head of the household, Sam Neill, had to dispatch him, that retribution was needed in order that the world could be at rest again. That was their theory. And so Billy Zane, we reshot the ending, and Billy copped a flare in the mouth from Sam Neill.
I didn't understand that. I thought that that's fascinating. So the Americans demanded justice.
They wanted justice because revenge is a big motif throughout their society and history. We're in a revenge cycle right now, aren't we?
We certainly are, Philip. Now, you've had a couple of very powerful women, film industry wives, but I was intrigued that in the book, it's your daughter who emerges as the major influence. In fact, much of Ingo's book is a tribute to this impressive young woman.
Lucia, yep. She's a sage. I think she's probably, possibly, one of the most experienced filmmakers in the Australian film industry, in as much as she's grown up in the cinema from day one. She's been there watching the gestation of movies from first idea right through pre-production shooting. She's been on all the publicity tours. She's seen the tantrums, the antics of superstars and super directors and mortals as well. And I always turned to her for advice. I turned to her on Sliver after I'd completed the first cut. I showed it to her. I said, "What do you think?" She, with a big smile on her face, said, "Have you done the deal on your next movie?" I said, "Why?" She said, "Because if I were you, I would not show this film to any other human being in the world until you get another job, Dad."
I love her insight at the age of 10 when she spots Clancy coming out of his compound surrounded by razor wire and laser beams in battle fatigues and says to you, "I think he's making a statement, Dad."
She's always been right. She's now decided to put her talents, her insight, to work for the rest of us. She's working for Amnesty International.
Oh, good on her. Good on her.
In Los Angeles, having started with them in Dublin. But, she's her latest project, and gosh, I wish her luck. She's trying to convince celebrities to give up wearing diamonds. And
this
take
is because
up pearls.
Of the diamond trade in Africa.
So, good luck.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because all too often, well, no, it's not a criticism, one sees the children of one's erstwhile friends, the Beresfords, the Skepsis and so on, now working in the industry. She's walked away from it.
Not completely. Not completely, because she's also doing some work with Amnesty Films in Los Angeles. But she intends to walk away from it. She's trying to. It's just that Amnesty, given her connections and her experience, keep wanting to put her back in the world of celebrities.
Philip, it's been a tonic to talk to you. Philip Noyce, Backroads to Hollywood. The book by Ingo Petsky is published by Macmillan. And all of us at Late Night Live agree it's a ripping, ripping good read. In fact, I can't wait for the film version.